Morning, everybody. It's nice to be back. I'm getting the full cultural experience of Brooklyn. I spent Shabbat in Aleppo, sorry, in the Syrian community, and now spending Sunday morning with you, and this is a true delight. I want to go straight to our topic. You have Mizmor Chav Zayin in front of you, Perek Chav Zayin of Tehillim, which is on page 170 in the Sidur, and just an intro to teaching Tehillim. Whenever we're studying a Perek of Tehillim, we have to address three different issues, always. One issue is, what do the words mean? Pretty straightforward. I don't know what the words mean. The second thing is, what's the structure of the Perek? We have to remember that Tehillim are all written in poetic form. They are songs, and they were written to be performed in the Mikdash by the Levi'im with musical accompaniment. So we always have to ask the question, what is the structure, which will then lead us to the third question, which is, what is the message? Now that's with any Perek of Tehillim you want to study, whether it's Al Narot Bavel, or whether it's B'Shuv Hashem at Shivat Zion, or Sinai El Harim, or Mima Makim, etc. I could go on and be here all morning just listing them. There's 150 Pirkei Tehillim. However, with a large group of Pirkei Tehillim, you have to ask a fourth question. Because there are many Pirkei Tehillim that we say outside of Zog and Tillim. We say them in the context of Tefillah, in the context of Slichot, in the context of Hallel, in all sorts of contexts. And the question is, what does that Perek have to do with that context? What does that add to it? So, for instance, a week from tomorrow, are we scared yet? A week from tomorrow, we're going to be standing up to hear the shofar. And just before that, we're going to be reciting Perek Mem Zayin, Kol Ha'amim Tikuchaf, seven times. So, of course, it's worth not only studying that Perek and understanding what its message is, but what it has to do with Tkiyat Shofar and why it was selected. I want to address the same question when we study Hashem Ori V'Yishi. Although there's something odd about Hashem Ori V'Yishi in its use in liturgy, why it's in your Sidur, that's a twofold strangeness. The first thing about it is that it is a most recent custom, a very recent custom, to say Hashem Ori V'Yishi at all as part of davening. It perhaps is 300 years old, if even that. Now, of course, in the outside world, 300 years old is a dinosaur. But in our world, 300 years old is yesterday. 300 years old, 18th century. Maybe 17th century. There's no record of anybody reciting this Perek as part of davening during any particular time of the year until then. It caught like wildfire in many communities. Many Sephardi communities do not say it. The students of the Lagon don't say it. There's whole groups that don't say it at all. But the second strange thing about it is when it's said. It is said twice a day during what season? Now, but not just Sunday morning with bagels. Elul through Sukkot. And that's what's strange. Because if you think about it, we have many minhagim, including things that we say and things that we do and things that we eat and things that we avoid eating during parts of this season. Elul and maybe Elul through Yom Kippur is seen as a penitential season. And so therefore, during the first 10 days of Tishrei, we have all sorts of minhagim, avoiding pat palter and adding things into our tefillah, etc. We have things that we do during the month of Elul. We have shofar every day until Erev Rosh Hashanah. We have, of course, minhagim of the month of Tishrei, like many people have honey all month, right? And then we have minhagim, of course, of Sukkot, which are festive. There is no single minhag you can point to that goes from Rosh Chodesh Elul until through Sukkot. See if you can find one that accompanies the entire season from, if you will, penitential to celebratory, from slichot to Simchat Beit HaShoevah. So that's something else that's odd about this, is this Perek surpasses and encompasses the entire seasons. So we got to figure out why. So in order to do so, let's study a Perek of Tehillim together. And along the way, we'll ask some questions. Now, the question I want to pose to you is something I alluded to a couple minutes ago. Every Perek of Tehillim was composed to be performed musically. We do not have a masoret about what it sounded like, about what instruments were used. However, in many cases, we do have a masoret about which group of Levim performed it. Lam Natseach Livnei Korach Mizmor. Mizmor Le'asaf. These are all Levitic families. Take a look in Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Vav. These are all Levitic families that later on you read in Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Chafet Chaf Gimel, David assigned to be the musicians in the Mikdash. Okay. But we do know that they were performed musically. So I'm going to ask you this question. Along the way, think, and then I'll evoke from you some answers. What musical instruments would you use to accompany this? And don't worry about period instruments. We'll use contemporary instruments. And the other thing is, for the musicians out there, minor or major? Minor or major? Now, I know you're instinctively going to say minor, because all Jewish music is minor. Right? Those of us who learned guitar as kids, just to be able to play the Kumsitz, knew everything was A minor, D minor. It's like, you know, simple. But the reality is, it's not like that. So what do you think about that? What instruments and what key? Or what tone? All right, let's take a look. Le David. Now, what does Le David mean? By the way, Le David, important to note, is not part of the chapter. It is what Chachamim referred to as the koteret, and what is, in English, the fancy word if you want to impress people at parties, although I promise you won't get invited back, is superscription. Superscription, right? Write it down and forget it. But the koteret Le David. We have kotarot that are as short as one word, like this. We have kotarot that are a few words, like Lamanatseach means more than David. We have kotarot that are as long as an entire pasuk, like in Nuntet, for instance. 100 out of the 150 perkei Tehillim in our collection of Tehillim. The reason I say our collection is because in the there are Rishonim who count 147 perkei Tehillim, because in their collections, some of the perkim were actually together that we have separate. But in our collection of 150 Pirkei Tehillim, in our Tanachim, 100 out of the 150 have some form of a koteret. As short as a word, as long as two psukim. But Chachamim never think of those as part of the Perek. I know you're looking at me with, how can you say such a thing? I'll give you proof from something that you said yesterday. Towards the at the end of davening, we recite a Mishnah from Masechet Tamid. And the Mishnah goes as follows. You didn't know it from Masechet Tamid, but you all know the Mishnah. Hashir, Shalvim, Hayom Rim, Bevet HaMikdash. And then what does it say? Ooh, pages have come. Thank you. Ooh. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Okay. Color. And okay, we are. Great. Okay. Oh, I thought that was applause for the source sheet.
Who is it? Who is it? Go around to the cane and hold on.
Okay. They didn't want to miss one more minute. There should be, looks like there's plenty to go around. Right. Okay. Good. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. And in that Mishnah, in Masechet Tamid, what do Chachamim say? How do they refer to the Prakim? Bayom HaRishon HaYom Rim. Remember? Bayom HaRishon HaYom Rim. You can look it up in your Siddurim if you want. La'adonai ha'aretz u'mo'a tevel v'yoshveva. They leave out the words of David Mizmor. B'shani HaYom Rim. Gadol Adonai Mulal Mayod B'ir Eloheinu HaKodesho. They leave out Mizmor Shir Livnei Korach. The first six of them, they ignore the opening, the ones that have an opening. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday have openings. They ignore them. The only one they mention the opening is, where they mention only the opening is, Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbat, and that's because of its own drasha. Chachamim never referred to it that way. If you would come up to somebody, to one of Chachamim, and say, we have a minhag before Birkat HaMazon on Shabbat and Yom Tov to say Shir HaMalot, they look at you like you're from another planet. Shir HaMalot, there's 15 of them. Which one? Oh, we say B'Shuv Hashem and Shiva Tzion. Okay, that we get. So the Davin is not properly part of the parak, and you could see it the way I laid it out now that we have the page as kind of separate from the text. That's how Chachamim look at it. However, what does the word L'David mean? What does L'David Mizmor mean? What does Mizmor L'David mean? You were here for Shalos Sodas yesterday? You sang Mizmor L'David? What does Mizmor L'David mean? What does L'David mean? Say it again? For David, which means somebody wrote it for David. Right, which means what? David commissioned him. David said, "Listen, I want you to write a really cool song." Said, "Okay, this is dedicated to David." Possibility one of David, which means he wrote it. Le David authorship. Now the reality is that when we see these sort of names, especially the David, there are different approaches depending on the parak. An example of that is parak Kuf Chafbet, which is Shir Malo the David, which is clearly not by David. Now, important note before you start running out or throwing bagels at me, Chachamim are clearly a consensus opinion that Tehillim were not all written by David. They're written by a whole collection of people, and there's a machloket about whether David was the final one or Ezra was the final one. But because some people, when they hear this parak is not written by David, they... Okay. But it's important to note, Masachet Bava Batra, Daf Yodal Amabet, take a look at the Sugya, and Midrash Shir Hashirim Rabbah on the Pasuk Tel Talpio. But here, in this parak, it seems like a very strong argument that here, Le David means written by David. There are too many signals in this parak that point to David's personal life, personal career, personal aspirations, and personal disappointments that make Le David a real mark, is written by David. Okay, so let's take a look at it. Now, get our instruments ready. What are we going to select? Keep it in mind. Adonai ori v'yish'i mimi ira. Adonai ma'oz chayai mimi efchad. So what is the singer? What is David saying here? Hashem is my light and my salvation. That's a beautiful sentiment. What does mimi ira literally mean? From whom am I afraid? But what? That's a rhetorical way of saying, I'm not afraid of anybody. Hashem is the strength of my life. That's a parallel. That's how shira, how biblical poetry is written. Mimi efchad. The same idea in parallel. And everybody in the world except for the Malbim agrees that biblical poetry is written that way and that these are parallel phrases. But notice the statement of confidence. I'm not afraid of anybody because Hashem is with me. Okay, so think about the instruments, but let's get a couple more psukim down before we get there. Now, the word krov here is a little play on words. Krov means when they come close, but it alludes to another word, which is krav, which is a battle. Bikrov alai mireim, when evil people get close to me, le'achol et b'sari, they want to devour me. Hema kashlu v'nafalu. Now notice, I don't go out and beat them. I watch them trip over themselves and fall. I don't have to do anything. I'm sitting here having shalos sedus, and these guys come, and as they're coming to attack me, they trip over each other and they fall. Right? It's a wild thing. Now, who are these people? They are coming, l'achol epsarit, sarai v'oivayli. These are my enemies, my foes. Hemakash don't follow. They trip over themselves. And that gets better. Im tachane alai machane lo yira libi. And again, lo yira. Im tachane alai machane. What does the word tachane mean? It's a verb. To set up a camp. But this is third person feminine. It's so confusing because I always thought my whole life, I thought tachane is you set up a camp. If a camp sets itself up. Now to set up a camp in Tanakh is a statement of preparing for war. We're setting up a camp, meaning we're preparing to go to war. Im tachane alai machane, thank you. Im tachane alai machane lo yira libi. You set up a camp against me, I'm not afraid. Now notice, I'm not afraid doesn't mean that I'm getting ready and making plans, but I'm hoping I'm going to win. It means I'm not even doing anything. I'm just sitting there enjoying while I know that nothing's going to happen. Im takum alai milchama. So if that camp turns into an actual war, bezot ani boteach, I'm confident. Now at this point, I'm going to ask you, tell me what instruments you use for this. Trumpet. By the way, when I teach this year, that's always the first one that comes out, and I agree, trumpet. I would say sousaphone, but not many people know what it is. All right? What else? What other instruments might you use? A big bass drum, maybe. I don't know. Okay, and what major or minor is this thing? Da-da-da-dum. This is marching, right? King Charles III. Right? This is powerful. This is confident. I'm not afraid of anybody. Keep that in mind. And our orchestra's all set up here with trumpets, trombones, flugelhorns. We got the whole brass section going. We're doing everything in major, upbeat, big drums. Put some cannons in the middle. All right? What was your 18? Yeah.
I have a question. Do we know at what point in his life he wrote this?
We have no idea. Although we're gonna try to isolate it, and I think you'll find that it either reflects a late life reflection back, or else composed in two parts or two stages. Okay, good. Good question. Now, you have to remember, David is also in the Middle East. We forget, we're from the Middle East. Okay, so remember, when you come and say, I want one thing, what you really mean is I want a bunch of things. You're bargaining, it's in the shuk. Watch. Achat sha'alti meit Adonai ota avakesh. How would you translate achat sha'alti? Is that what? I asked for one. I'm going to add one word to it, which fits the tone of this. Because I'm confident of A, and I'm confident of B, and I'm confident of C. There's only one thing I ask. There's just one thing I ask. Because everything else I've got. I'm confident my enemies are going to fall. I'm confident that no war can defeat me. I'm so confident that I'm not even preparing for war. I'm sitting and watching as they stumble over each other. It's great. So I only have one thing to ask. Now, by the way, this pasuk is a beautiful pasuk. I highlighted it on the page. It is a pasuk that we have a fast song for and a slow song for and other songs for. It's great. We say shifty 14 times and go, woo! We have a great fun time with it. And yet, there's something a little bit off in this pasuk if you look at it in the context. Achat sha'alti meit Adonai ota avakesh. There's one thing I ask God. I'm going to say only one thing I ask for God. That's what I request. What's the one thing I want? So again, there's not just one thing. Shifti beveit Adonai kol yemei chayai. I want to sit in the house of Hashem my whole life. This, by the way, is a clear David pointer. Because the one thing David was denied was building the mikdash. But he's not done with that. I want to gaze at the beauty of Hashem, and levaker is a tricky word, so a small tangent to explain it. What does levaker mean? So think about how strange that is. I want to sit there forever and also visit. It's a little weird. You'd go the opposite way. I want to visit and then not leave. That's how I feel every time I come here. I don't want to go back. But to say I want to be there forever and also visit is a little strange. So it's important to note that Hebrew is a living language. And the meaning of words in Tanakh is not necessarily the same meaning as words in rabbinic Hebrew. Chachamim say this in Masachet Avodah Zarah. Lashon Torah Lachud, Lashon Chachamim Lachud. Rabbinic Hebrew is not the same as medieval Hebrew, and medieval Hebrew is not the same as modern Hebrew. And I could give you a bunch of examples, but I want to stay on the top. The word levaker in rabbinic Hebrew and in modern Hebrew means to visit. Bikur cholim. Levaker in Tanakh means something different. It means to investigate. It's used, for instance, in Vayikra Perek Yotet, when talking about the Shivcha Harufa, Bikoret Tihiyat. Chachamim even utilize the word in that meaning when they talk about a korban, meaning Bikur Dalad Yamim. It has to be investigated and checked. The Ibn Ezra, in his commentary on Sefer Bereshit, says that the reason that morning, not dawn, which is shachar, because it's black, shachor, But rather, morning is called boker, as it's the first time of day that you can investigate things clearly. All right, levaker. And so, levaker be'echalo seems to mean I'd like to sit and be able to think clearly about God. David wants to sit in the mikdash and just sit there and soak up godliness, and that's the one thing I've asked of God. Okay? Now, he continues, ki itzpeneni b'suko b'yom ra'ah. And the key here is unclear. Key almost never means because in Tanakh. Here it means rather or perhaps because, perhaps indeed, yitzpeneni b'suko b'yom ra'ah. He hides me in his sukkah on a bad day. Now, by the way, this is a little strange because according to this, David doesn't have bad days. What it means that, seems to mean, is that if there is a day where there's a threat, God protects me. And where does he protect me? He hides me in his sukkah. A little unclear what that means, and it seems to be a metaphor. He hides me in some protective place. And by the way, there are those who point to this pasuk as being the reason we say this all the way through Sukkot. I don't think that's the reason, but that's what they point to. Yastireini v'seter ohalo. Now this one's even trickier. Because if you recall, David brought the Aron from Kiryat Yarim, Baba Bugosh, to Yerushalayim. Of course, was denied the opportunity to build the Mikdash, but he set up a tent. And the Aron is in the tent. He put a Mizbeach in front of it. And our inclination is to think that that's what the Ohel that he's referring to. But I don't think so. I think the Ohel here, again, is metaphoric. Because David is not attacked when he's in Yerushalayim. Once David's in Yerushalayim, there's no attack on the city, except when he has to run away from his own son. So the ohel and the sukkah here seem to be metaphoric of saying God enfolds me and protects me. And not only that, but Tsur Yerom Imeini. A tsur is an outcropping on the top of a hill. A tsur means a rock, but tsur here means a cropping of rocks where you can be lifted up. You can go up, climb up there, and you're safe from your enemies. A, they can't see you, and B, they can't get up there. And that, of course, takes us to the story of David and Shaul, when David is able to be safe from Shaul in Maoz HaTzur. And now, V'ataya rumo shia levais v'otai. And now my head is lifted up. And it's important to know, because we're going to get to this in the second half, the motif in Tanakh of looking down at someone is always a statement of victory, and being looked down upon is a statement of defeat. Whether it's literally that way or the image is that way, that's the way the Tanakh describes it. V'atayo rum roshi aloi vais vivotai. So God lifts up my head above my enemies who are around me, meaning I look down on them. And meantime, I'm not fighting because they're tripping over each other. So what am I doing? What do? I come into his tent. Now, this is likely the tent we're talking about because I bring korbanot there, and they are called zivchei trua, which some people will point to here as being the Rosh Hashanah connection, possibly. Not likely, because zivchei trua seems to mean korbanot that are brought with a lot of sound, meaning very festive. Ashira v'zamra l'Adonai. Okay, are we all comfortable with saying this is trumpets in major till now? This is confident and this is successful and maybe even a little bit too much? Okay, so you saw that I put a line of some musical notes between them. Okay. The para continues, and this is, by the way, I'll share with you as a teacher that one of the difficulties in teaching Tehillim is, depending on the para, is Tehillim that are, if I teach Lamed Zion, it's actually easy. Lamed Zion is a para nobody knows. Nobody knows it because it's not part of our davening. I don't mean nobody knows it, but it's not familiar to us. You start teaching this and people are saying the words with you because we all know it. That makes it more difficult because we all know it so well, we don't stop to think what we don't know. And when we're reciting it at lightning speed, which is what we do in davening, right? We say, Asher HaZamah, and we don't notice that there's been this dramatic change. So that's why we do a shiur. It doesn't mean we just have to slow down in shul, it just means this, and maybe we should, but that's why we take time to learn it and look at it and see what's going on. And hopefully when you say it this evening, and tomorrow morning, there'll be a new light there. Okay. Shema Adonai Koli. Just starting with those three words. Just starting with the first word. What has changed? Hear my voice, Hashem. What? What about the confidence? Yeah, yeah. So what do you got? What does it mean when somebody says Shema Hashem Koli?
Needing.
What?
Needing.
Needing. What else? Not so confident. Asking. Well, or asking for God to hear me, which means I don't think God is hearing me. I don't try to get your attention if you're all listening to me. Saying Shema Hashem Koli means I think you're not listening to me. Please listen to me. We pled it last night, Shema Koleinu. We'll continue doing that for the next couple of weeks. That means we're afraid God's not listening. What happened here? And it gets better or worse, but it gets stronger. Ekra v'choneni v'aneni. Choneni, have compassion on me. Aneni, answer me. And as we say in Japanese, Vasa Geshendo. You didn't know I spoke Japanese, right?
I thought it was Chinese.
What? I always get confused. What happened here? That this person is suddenly so confident. I don't need to worry about my enemies, and I bring korbanot, and I sing, and I dance, and all great. And the only one failing, and suddenly, where are you, God? Please help me.
He alluded to that at the beginning when he says he's aware, he's conscious of the fact the Krovolai Barayim Levos is sorry.
Yeah, right.
So he knows that already. That may be his default position. That may be his default thing. He's very grateful and he's very conscious of Hashem's helping.
Right.
But his default position is, I got Tzaras.
Could be.
And that continues here, why he says, Shema Hashem Koli.
Good, so what do you do with the instruments now?
Violin.
Okay, so you're going to put the trumpets down, pick up a violin, I'm with you. What about the music? It goes minor. It goes quieter, and it's gone from, I don't know, L'chol Maminim uptune, right? It's suddenly very slow and quiet and plaintive, and it's a very different thing. That's why I put the notes in there. By the way, it gets stronger. Now, you may be right, but we still have a fundamental shift in what's going on. And by the way, important to note, Pirkei Tehillim, for the most part, are singular in that way. They're not monotonal, but they're singular in that Hashem ro'i lo achsar we would have with a quiet classical guitar. Hashem ha'artzum lo'a, we said this morning as the means more, would definitely be trumpets. So sharim ha'shechem, it's all one theme. And it doesn't change. It changes a little bit, there's a development, but not so radical. We got to figure out what's going on. Yeah.
Is there anything to that the turning point seems to be when we bring the carbon? Immediately after we say Zipei Shua, which sounds celebratory, but
right.
As soon as we're bringing the carbon, all of a sudden we're saying Shema Hashem, which one of the
things. I would love that if it stopped here. I would love that. That'd be great. If right after bringing the carbon, he said Shema Hashem Koli, and then Selah, we'd be great. The problem is what happens next. Okay, but no, that's a great idea. You understand what he's saying? Is that maybe that proximity of the Korban means that I suddenly realize I've got to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's great. But let's keep see what's going on because it gets worse. It gets better, but it gets worse, meaning it devolves. L'cha amar li mi bakshu fanai. My heart told me that I should seek out you. Or in English, I should seek you out. So I'm going to do that, meaning my heart was speaking to me, and it said, find God, which means I'm in trouble. And so, okay, I'm going to try to find you. I'm going to try to look for you. By the way, if I'm seeking your face, what does that tell me? That you have turned your face away, and now I have to find you. Years ago, I remember being at a friend's house, and his mom, secular woman, had a little post-it on her refrigerator. This is when they first started having refrigerators, a long time ago. And she had a note on it that said, if it seems that God is far away, guess who moved? Oh, what deep muster that is. And so he's saying, okay, I've got to seek you out. Al taster panecha mimeni. This is not the same tone as a few psukim ago. Don't turn your face away from me, please. Al tat be'af avdecha. Tat is short for tate. Don't turn away be'af, in anger, from me. And by the way, for the first time, he refers to himself as avdecha, your servant. Ezrati hayita. You were the one who helped me. Al ticheni v'al tazveni Elohei Yishi. Don't abandon me and don't leave me. You are the God of my salvation. Now notice that he's using Yishi again as he did in the beginning, but in the beginning it was a statement of fact, and here it's part of his argument, please come back. You're the one who's supposed to save me. And it gets stronger. The heartstrings get pulled here. Ki avivi mi azavuni. Now, whether that's literal, and it's being stated when David has handed his parents over to Melech Moab and never sees them again, evidently, or whether it's just metaphorically, the idea of everybody around me has left me, all my support system is gone, avivi mi azavuni, vadunai asfeni, God will bring me in, is not a statement of fact, it's a prayer. Please, God, I'm all alone, I got nobody, please bring me in. And then he says, horeini adonai darkecha. Hashem, show me your way. Show me your way. Why? Clearly, I'm off the path. And I need to be brought back to the path, which is going to bring me back to you, and watch his argument. Uncheini biorach mishor, lead me in the straight path. And then his argument is interesting. What was Moshe's argument when Hashem said, I'm going to destroy all of Am Yisrael because of the ego? What was Moshe's argument? If you're not familiar, we're going to hear it a week from Wednesday. What?
The other nations,
they
couldn't do it.
Say it again?
That the other nations
there we go. The Egyptians are going to say, oh, God took him out in the desert, and then he couldn't defeat the kings of Canaan. It's going to be a chilul Hashem. Two arguments are the Brit with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Israel is mentioned there. And the chilul Hashem. Watch what he says. He makes that in a micro sense. Leman shorarai. Now, shorarai can be read in three different ways. All lead to the same thing. Shorarai could mean what? Shorarai?
My singers? My singers? Like the people who are
still
sing, rejoice.
The people who are singing at me. Na, 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 right? But obviously much more powerful. No, 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 right? But it's the people who are singing at me, singing in the sense of jeering at me. What's another possibility is shorarai is a form of tsorarai, my enemies. And Shorai may also be related to the word Ashurenu, which we find in the Song of Bilam, the poetry of Bilam, which means to look down from a high wall. Banot Ale Shur in the Bracha de Yosef. So, but they're all the same thing. The people who are looking down at me, the people who are laughing at me, the people, my enemies, the people who are singing at me, I want you to come back to me, show me the proper way, bring me back, so they can't do that. Now, the argument may even be more sophisticated than that. It may be, I am your king. I am the one who represents you. I'm the one who carries the banner, and it's a chilul Hashem that these enemies are looking down at me. So for that sake, or it might be personal. Please save me so people aren't making fun of me and treating me like dirt. Yeah.
This has anything to do with
ooh, it could be. It could be. Let's, when we get to the end, let's try to figure out a time frame for these. And we won't be able to nail down. We could make suggestions. Correct. Very good. Al tineini benefesh tsarai. Now, if you remember at the beginning of the parak, he said, when enemies come to devour me, right, and they stumble and fall. The imagery, and we're not necessarily seeing cannibalism here, but the imagery of the enemy devouring me is the most graphic, one of them, not exactly, but second most graphic image used in Tanakh for utter defeat. Doesn't mean they're actually eating me, but, and here, al tineini benefesh tsarai. The word nefesh, remember I mentioned earlier that Hebrew in Tanakh and Hebrew in Chazal and Hebrew in medieval times and Hebrew today are not necessarily used, words are not used the same way. What does nefesh mean?
Soul.
A soul, right. Except in Tanakh, not doesn't mean a soul. Is there a soul in Tanakh? Notein neshama l'amalea, maybe, but nefesh does not mean a soul. What does nefesh mean in Tanakh?
Life.
Adam hu nefesh, a person, nefesh ki techta. And in some places in Tanakh, nefesh means throat.
What?
Mm-hmm. throat. Kiva umayim ad nafesh. Tehillim samachtet. The waters have come up my throat. Al tineni benefesh tsarai. Don't let me go into the gullet of my enemies. Again, this imagery of them eating me. And what's his argument for innocence here? Ki kamuvi eide sheker vifeach chamas. Eifeach is a difficult word until we use a concordance and take a look at it in Mishlei and see it refers to testimony or witnesses. Yifeach chamas means lying witnesses, parallel to eide sheker. And this again is a straight David connection, because what does David say to Shaul? Remember the episode in the cave where David cuts the corner of Shaul's garment, and then Shaul leaves, and David calls to him from a distance, and then David says to him that there are people who are lying, who are telling you that I'm trying to kill you. You could see I'm not. And arim heim lifnei Adonai. They are cursed before God, ki gershuni, etc. David is a victim of false witnesses in the Shaul scenarios, in the Shaul cycle. And so that may be indeed what he's complaining about here. Before we get to the last two psukim, I'd like to address what you brought up earlier about time frame. What would conceivably be the time frame of these last psukim? I've been abandoned, I'm all alone, I'm being chased, my enemies want to devour me. So we can really only point to one particular period in David's life and then a possible second. But I'm not enamored with the second choice. The first one is during the years when David is on the run from Shaul. Because David is very much isolated. And even sometimes his small, loyal band of renegades, which is who joins him, who are on the run, they're not necessarily with him. And they're not necessarily in on his plans. And sometimes he has to yell them down. They all want to kill Shaul. He says he can't do that. So David is very much alone. And he's being chased. And he's being threatened. And he feels very much isolated. You could make the argument that this refers to David running away from Avshalom, when Avshalom comes to take the city. You could make that argument, but it's very hard to argue everybody's abandoned me when he has a very strong, loyal group that stays with him and an army that fights with him that ultimately defeats and kills Avshalom and Yoav, etc. So I'd rather put that in that period. When would you then put the first period? So there I think the Bathsheba story plays a role, because how did the Bathsheba story happen? How did David even see Bathsheba, that all that terrible stuff happened from there? He was home. Where was Bathsheba's husband? So the first thing that's wrong in that story is, why isn't David on the battlefront? This is the first time we hear about David not leading the troops in the battle, but sitting back and directing them from a distance. And everything falls apart from there. And so it's possible that that's right before this. It could be that period of, my enemies, they fall. Maybe. I don't know. But now we get to the penultimate pasuk. And the penultimate pasuk is a mystery, because it's an incomplete pasuk. Lulei ha'mati lirot betuv Adonai be'eretz chayim, what? Because what does it mean? If it were not for the fact that I had full faith that God would eventually bring me to Eretz HaChayim, which in David's lexicon is Eretz Yisrael, that's the way he used it. If it were not for that, then he leads off the rest. I would have given up hope. I would have fallen on my sword. He doesn't say that. And this is not uncommon in Tanakh, when something is going to be uttered that is so horrific that the substitute is to leave it blank. It is used most commonly in Tanakh in oaths. When a person says, I'm taking an oath not to do something, the way they say it is, I swear, and they use Hashem's name in one form or another, if I do X. What does if I do X mean? So it means I'm not going to do X. But what it means is, ultimately, if I do X, the most terrible thing should happen to me. But I'm not going to say it. And so that seems to be what's happening here. He's saying, if it were not for the fact that I had faith in Hashem, that he would ultimately bring me back, use your imagination. And the last pasuk is yet a bit stranger. We all know it, and some of us, perhaps we'll show our age, remember one of the earliest Jewish rock songs, Kaveh Hashem. Rabbi Sons, I think. Right? Not such a rock song, but it's fun. Right? Kaveh El Adonai Chazak V'yamitz Libecha V'Kaveh El Adonai. Now, by the way, notice that everything till now has been autobiographical. This is what happens to me. This is how I feel. My heart said to me, I'm seeking you out. It's a dialogue between David and God. And then suddenly, it's like a directive to the audience. It's in the imperative. Kaveh, you should pray, or you should hope. Here it probably means pray. It says it twice, with the intermezzo here of Chazak V'yamitz Libecha. What's going on here? So I'd like to make the following suggestion to explain this parak. First of all, if you turn the page, you could see we've gone through the parak, we've gone through the words, we know what the words mean. The structure of this parak is actually very straightforward. It is exactly two halves, and you could see if you count the words, you'll end up with almost exactly the same amount of words in each half. And the first half ends with the trumpets of the korbanot, and then Shema Hashem Koli is the second half. And Kaveh El Hashem really is the binder that brings the whole parak together. So I'd like to suggest in bringing this all together to answer both the third and fourth question. What's the message of this, and what's its propriety for the liturgy, the way we use it, and specifically the oddity of using it from Rosh Chodesh Elul all the way through Hoshana Rabbah, or Shmini Atzeret. The first half of this parak describes somebody who is at the pinnacle of things. Somebody who has achieved tremendous success to the point where they wake up in the morning and they don't have to check the paper because they know whatever they invested in the day before is up. And they check it just to, you know, have that good feeling. They're not concerned. When they hear that there is a plague going around, they're not concerned because it's not going to affect me. And their confidence is confirmed when indeed they're not affected. Earlier I spoke about David being confident, and I alluded to the fact that he's maybe a little too confident. I think if you listen to the first half, there is really overweening confidence. It's not just that I know Hashem is with me, Baruch HaGever Sheiftach Ba'Adonai, Vaya Adonai Miftacho, and I'm going to go into battle, and I know Hashem is going to help me win. It's I can just sit back, and He takes care of my enemies for me. Somebody in a situation like that could easily fall into the trap. I know people like this. You may know people like this. Of thinking, not I don't believe in God, but I don't really need God on a daily basis because I've already got my back pocket. It's already there. God's on my side, to paraphrase Bob Dylan. And so, of course, I'll say Baruch Hashem. Of course, I'll say Berachat HaGomel. Of course, I'll give some tzedakah, etc. But on a daily basis, okay, I'll come to Shul and Daven, but on a daily basis, I don't want to reach out to God and say, thank you for everything you've given me, and please continue. Because it's already mine. And then you look at the other extreme. I've been teaching in schools for close to 40 years. And what I've seen happen over the course of the last 2.5 years or so is devastating. And I will tell you that the Jewish schools have done way better than the public schools. But the sense of hopelessness, the sense of isolation, the sense of a dark tunnel with no light at the end, which has enveloped so many of our teenagers in the last couple of years, I'm not here to critique policy, I'm just pointing it out a reality. It's something that we are going to be dealing with for a generation. I now have seniors who had half of ninth grade. That's it. We now have taking in ninth graders into school who didn't have a real middle school experience. And it's devastating. And thank God we have done a great job throughout the Jewish community of providing all sorts of other avenues for kids to have with camp and with youth organizations and Shabbos and family and everything else. But you know what's going on in the outside world? It's scary. And there are people out there, and we may know people like this, and we may have sometimes felt this way in our lives, where we felt that it was so dark, it was so distant, we were so isolated that there's no point in calling out because there's nobody there who's going to listen. If putting up against the wall and say, sure, I believe in God, but he's not listening to me. People feel like that. And this perek is a united perek, a unified perek that describes both extremes from a biographical perspective. Which is why it's successful. Because it's one thing to give mussar. It's another thing to talk about yourself and people can identify with it. I was on top of the world, doing great. Hey, Ma, how you doing? I was devastated. I was at the bottom. That's why so often at our NCSY Shabbatonim and at camp, we bring motivational speakers. They don't inspire, they tell. They tell their own story, and that inspires. It's very powerful. That's what David's doing here. He's saying you can be on top, so on top that you think I don't need to reach out to Hashem on a daily basis. I'll say the words, but I don't really need to really reach out. Because tomorrow's guaranteed. And then, of course, there's the opposite, which is feeling so isolated that there's nobody there. The last pasuk is the salvation of the whole thing. To the first person who feels like everything's great, Kaveh Hashem, you better pray to Hashem. You ought to realize where it all comes from, realize how quickly it can be taken away, but more critically, realize that the one anchor in your life, the one central thing that you can rely on is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Pray to Hashem. Connect to Hashem. And to the person who feels isolated, who feels hopeless, who feels like there's absolutely no way it's going to get better, Chazak v'yametz libecha, strengthen yourself, v'kaveh el Hashem. And it's as if David is saying, you who are flying high and you who are sitting low, I want you guys to stand together in shul and daven. And I want to hear you both crying. The month of Elul is a month that if we were to take it seriously, and we all take it seriously to one measure or another, but if we were to take it to its ultimate seriousness, it would devastate us. To look back at the year, who can look back at the past year and say, I'm good with God, everything's fine. Nobody's honest. We're humans, we make mistakes. It could be devastating. The answer is Kaveh el Hashem. And then comes Sukkot. We are sitting there with all the bounty of the year, the biggest celebration of the year, bar none. The one that's defined as Zman Simchateinu. And the one where we're commanded to bring all of the bounty of the year and surround ourselves with it. Kaveh el Hashem. And so this perek, which brings together the extremes of experience and unifies them by saying, the one anchor, the one central feature in our lives that keeps us all together and keeps ourselves internally together is our dependence on Hashem and our awareness of a constant dependence on Hashem and an assurance that that dependence is responded to. And therefore, this is the perek that became the minhag to recite through the entire season of potential distance and, of course, actualized celebration. I want to wish you all a chatimah tovah, a tremendous rejoicing.